I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Tomorrow, in New York City, alleged Ponzi scheme mastermind Bernard Madoff is expected to plead guilty to 11 criminal charges, including fraud, money laundering, and perjury. Some of Madoff's investors will be allowed to address the court. One might be Ronnie Sue Ambrosino, who says she and her husband Dominic invested with Madoff for years and lost their $1.6 million life savings. Ronnie Sue is 56 years old. Her husband's 48. They retired 4 years ago, bought a luxury RV, and started traveling around the country. Now they're scrimping and living off Dominic's pension. Ronnie Sue also has organized an online group of more than 300 other Madoff investors, and she joins us on the line from Phoenix at the airport on her way to New York for Madoff's court appearance tomorrow. Hi, Ronnie Sue.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. What would you say to Bernard Madoff if you see him in court tomorrow?
You know, it's not really anything I'd want to say to Bernard Madoff. What I'd like to say to the judge is to please be mindful that we're trying to find our money, and before a plea is taken, I would really like to find out from the judge if he has ascertained that all the money's been accounted for, and if all the people who might be involved in this with Bernie have been accounted for.
And at this point, at least what it looks like in terms of what might happen in court, we may not find out where the money went.
Well, then I don't think a plea should be allowed to be taken. Mr. Madoff has been manipulating the system since the 90s when he pulled the wool over the eyes of the SEC, which continued to not be able to see his fraud. And I think it's time that the government takes control here. They have not been in control.
Have you met Bernard Madoff before?
No, I haven't.
How did you get involved with him?
About 28 or 29 years ago, my former husband's business associates knew of him and invested their profit-sharing plan with him, and we slowly got involved and over the years kept adding money, and my current husband and I sold our house 4 years ago and put all that money from the profits of the house in there as well as our savings over the years.
So what kind of returns were you getting on your investments?
It was averaging about 10% a year, regardless of whether the dot-coms were doing 20 and 30%. The beginning of this year, we got, I think our first quarter was about 2 or 3%. So, you know, people think that it didn't vary, but it did vary, and it was consistently profitable, but it did vary.
Mm-hmm. So do you know, over the years, have you ever counted, how much money do you think you made investing with Bernard Madoff?
No, you know, I don't. As you said, we are traveling in a motorhome, and as such, space is very limited. And we don't have those papers. I don't have papers going back to 28 years ago to know what I put in originally. So I really don't.
And what's your situation like right now?
Dominic's pension covers the mortgage on the motorhome. And for the last 3 months, we have cut down to zero spending. We have food expenses, and we're in an RV park that many of the people that are there have offered us to stay on their sites for no rent. So that's a saving grace. If we had to pay rent, we wouldn't be able to afford it. So we get jobs, we have absolutely nothing. My source of income should be, and I will fight until we get it, SIPC money that we are entitled to based on the last statement that we had.
That statement suggests the $1.6 million.
Yes.
Now,
yes,
we should explain. SIPC is the Securities Investor Protection Corporation, and that's a nonprofit agency that was set up by Congress. It is trying to liquidate Madoff's assets, and it's estimated that it should be able to pay up to $500,000 to people who directly invested with Madoff.
Yes, but to date, it's 3 months ago since Madoff confessed to his crime. To date, 12 checks have gone out. And that's a crime. This is money that people need to live on. People are losing houses. People have health problems that they can't take care of. I speak to 300 people. I hear horror stories. And SIPC has sent out 12 checks.
When you said that you make, you were making roughly 10% a year, a 10% return on more than a $1 million investment every year, would that be accurate?
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Some folks might be critical of that. You're 56 years old. Your husband is 48 years old. Some people might say, and I've certainly read blogs regarding what you've talked about online in terms of other Madoff victims. Some people have said, you know, you can work. You have a choice. You can go out and do this. What do you say to those people?
Well, thank you for bringing that up. I really appreciate that. I worked. I worked for 30 years. I worked smart. I saved. That's the American way. You work, you save your money, you plan for your future, you pay your taxes, you trust your government, and everything is fine. Well, unfortunately, I trusted my government, and everything is not fine. But all the pieces that I did were right. I did what the American dream is.
But the American dream can also obviously have someone like Bernard Madoff working there who is fraudulently doing some of these things. And some folks might think that some investors were willing to overlook what maybe would have been warning signs from Bernard Madoff because of the returns that they were getting on their investments. And that's why it was allowed to happen for so long.
Well, first of all, I can only speak for myself in this case. I'm not a sophisticated investor. If I was, I wouldn't need a stockbroker. Therefore, I rely on the agencies that are set up by the United States government to tell me who is legitimate and who is fraudulent. What kind of red flags would I know about? This is not my domain.
What do you think should happen to Mr. Madoff?
I think he should be made to tell where the money is and who else is involved.
They're talking about 150 years in prison, possibly.
Well, you know, if people think that the day he goes into jail, that this is all over and done, that's a very big mistake. It's not over and done. You have his brother, who is the chief compliance officer, his niece, who worked with the brother, his wife, and his two sons, who were all integral parts of this business. Every penny that was made through this business was illegitimate, except for the market-making business. Every penny that Peter, Ruth, Mark, Andrew, Shana, and her SEC, ex-SEC husband have should go back to the victims.
Ronnie Sue Ambrosino calls herself a victim of accused financier Bernard Madoff. She now runs the Bernard Madoff Fraud Victim Support Group online. Ronnie Sue, thanks very much for being with us.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, Ms. Ambrosino's retirement account is an extreme case, but many people have seen their retirement funds decimated by the down economy. Today, we're looking at pension funds for public employees. Right now, they're underfunded by more than $1 trillion. But the problem actually started long before this recession. For more than a decade, pension fund managers counted on bond sales to raise money when they fell short. It was quick cash and easier than trying to raise taxes to pay for retirement obligations. The problem is that very often the plans are paying out more to bondholders than they're taking in. David Evans is senior writer for Bloomberg Magazine. He writes about this in the most recent issue of the magazine. And David, your article explains how many municipalities are not acknowledging the size of this problem. What's going on?
The pension problem is the easiest problem to push off into the future. The problem is it won't be us paying for the services provided by public servants to us. It'll be our kids if we don't make these payments. And the big problem developed because all these future payments in pensions come from a combination of the contributions by the government employer, the contribution by the public employee, and whatever they can make in the stock market and the bond markets and hedge funds and real estate. And the more that they expected to do very well in those markets, obviously, the less they would need to collect in payments from workers and contributions from public entities. And so back around 2000, at the height of the dot-com boom, we had all or certainly many of the public pension funds were fully funded. The problem was they were counting on that party lasting into the future.
If for the past 9 years folks have been overestimating that rate of return and saying the party's still on, and we have actuaries telling us that, no, it's not really, it's over at this point, we don't have to listen to them and we can continue to act as if the party's still on. Is that pretty much what happened?
It's interesting. Virtually everyone uses an 8% expected rate of return, where they're figuring that their combination of investments, stocks and bonds and hedge funds and real estate, are going to make 8%, and they build everything around that. But when you think about it, it's a pretty optimistic rate. But they will say, well, gee, you can't look at 1 year. These expected rates of return are over the long term. The critics, though, will suggest that, sure, we had a spectacular bull market between 1980 and 2000, but that's not reasonable to expect for the long term.
And when we talk about this, we're talking about issuing bonds to a large degree. Can you explain that whole process?
Sure. There's some states and localities that figured out that one way to approach this problem of being very underfunded and not having the money that their actuaries tell them they need to have today to be able to pay off the pension obligation in the future would be to issue pension bonds. And again, relying on this idea that you can make 8% or in some cases 8.5%, they figure if they can sell bonds and pay an interest rate that's less than that, then they can actually make money. It's sort of like back in 1999, if you saw the stock market going crazy, you'd get a home equity loan and you could invest in the market. You're only paying maybe 8% on your home equity loan and you're making 20% in the market, and that's great. The problem is you're essentially becoming a hedge fund. You're leveraged. And if instead of making that much money each year, if you have a negative return, then you're much worse off than you were before. New Jersey in 1997 sold $2.8 billion of pension bonds. And in the story, we quote an interview that the then governor of New Jersey, Christine Todd Whitman, told us they were going to save $47 billion for taxpayers. Well, if their projections had held up, it would have been an ongoing benefit. But they paid 7.6% interest on those bonds. And over that period of time, they've only earned 4.8%. So instead of being an improved case for their state pension fund, it's actually in worse shape by more than $500 million. Just last year in Chicago, the Chicago Transit Authority, they sold $2 billion of pension bonds. They paid 6.8% interest, and so far they're only earning 2% interest. They actually had a situation where the state auditor general went and analyzed their deal to see if it made sense. The state auditor general determined that they would most likely lose money on having sold the pension bonds. Yet, despite that warning from the auditor general that the pension bonds didn't make sense, Chicago Transit Authority went ahead 2 weeks later and sold $2 billion of bonds.
David Evans is senior writer for Bloomberg Magazine. With these massive shortfalls, can future retirees expect the money to be there when they need it? And what can state and local agencies do to cut pension costs? Some are switching to 401k-type retirement plans for new employees. We'll hear about some other possible solutions, the politically difficult ones. Back with David Evans after a quick break. You're listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker. We've been talking with Bloomberg Magazine senior writer David Evans about pension plans for public employees and why they're short by about $1 trillion. And David, do you think retirees will eventually feel the effects of these shortfalls?
Well, I mean, the only way it would affect retirees is if the states and localities reneged on their obligations, if they went into bankruptcy and a bankruptcy judge said that these are no longer obligations that have to be paid out. The people who are going to be stuck with the bill are the people that are going to be taxpayers when the folks who are now working retire, and that lump of folks in the pipeline become retirees. And if there isn't enough money in the pension fund, then there will have to be cutbacks in other services or an increase in taxes, because from the research that I did, these are obligations that are pretty much set in stone. There are state constitutions that require these obligations to be paid out, and unless you can get folks to give back benefits that they've been looking forward to receiving their whole working lives, this is a problem that's going to hit, and if it doesn't hit us, it's going to hit our kids.
What about how might this problem be fixed? I mean, are there any folks who are talking about potential solutions right now?
Well, as I said, the only way to solve it is for the investments to produce higher returns. One of the problems is that pension bonds are part of a solution which involves taking bigger risks and hoping to get the bigger rewards that you need to make up the whole. But if you're a gambler at the table and you're not doing well and you start doubling up and doubling up, you know, you might have a good outcome, but you sure might be wiped out. I mean, they're gambling that they're going to be able to make up their losses, and in making that gamble, they're risking getting even deeper in the hole. I mean, a more conservative way, but certainly a more unpopular way, would be either to raise taxes or to cut spending in other areas. And ultimately, if you can get the public workers to accept lower benefits, then you're solving the problem at the root. But we haven't really seen any signs that givebacks are being offered by public unions.
Do you think that the government is going to have to step in and do something about this?
The government is responsible. I mean, that's certainly what our reporting showed. And one of those things that I just outlined is going to really have to happen. Hopefully, the markets will turn around and the pension bonds will become positive instead of negative. But the question raised is whether the government should be in the business of acting like a hedge fund and making leveraged bets on markets. I mean, what makes the government smarter than people like Warren Buffett?
David Evans, senior writer for Bloomberg Magazine, thanks very much for speaking with us about this topic.
It's been my pleasure.
Retirement planning is complicated, so why not start early? Three states currently require that high school students take a financial literacy class in order to graduate. Tennessee is one of them. Les Greer teaches business and economics and now personal finance at Riverdale High School in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Les, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Deborah.
Can you tell me, what does your course involve? What are you teaching the students?
Well, we teach students several things, from looking at career choices and income, to savings plans, retirement insurance, taxes, tax forms, obviously when they're looking for jobs. We talk to them about purchasing houses and mortgages, different loans they can obtain. We really focus on saving and investing, and we get into a little bit of spending and watching their credit.
Now, you're talking about 16 and 17-year-olds primarily, I would imagine.
Yes.
And you're talking about insurance and mortgages. Sounds like it's a bit of a jump.
Right, it is. And what I try to focus on with my students, I tell them these things may not be relevant right now, but you will see these things all the next 5 years. And that's what most of them don't understand once you say that to them. But in 5 years, they're going to be, you know, looking at their first job, trying to buy a house, looking at car insurance, looking at life insurance, and then setting up their retirement plans.
What would you say is the level of financial knowledge most students come into the class with?
When they enter in the class, on a scale of 1 to 10, I would say probably around a 2. You know, occasionally you will get a student that's somewhere around the 5, but most on the average for the class is around 2.
And when you say that, what does that mean? What don't they know?
They have a basic understanding of a little bit about money. They may have a checking account. They may have a savings account. About 50% of my students have a checking account, and then it drops down to about 20% that have a savings account. And so they have a general understanding of a bank account and somewhat on banks, but they don't have any understanding of different accounts in the bank, as far as a savings account or a money market account, any different interest rates between those two. And then obviously they don't have any kind of knowledge on mortgages or life insurance or even retirement planning. I mean, they've heard the term 401k, but they're not really sure how it's used. And one of the things that we try to do in the class is spark interest and get the parents involved with the students. Several of my students have come back in the class and they're talking with their parents about their investments in the stock market game. It's a simulation that we play in class. Or they talk to their parents about buying a car. And that's something that I encourage. And I think over, you know, over time in the course of this class, it gets the parents more involved. And I know I ask students in class all the time, how many of you talk about money with your parents? And, you know, I may have 2 or 3 kids in a class of 25 raise their hand. So there's not a whole lot of dialogue between the parents and student on money in general.
What or how do you think the whole recession and the economic crisis has affected what you teach? Has there been any effect at all in teaching kids about financial literacy with the recession being your backdrop?
It's actually been really good for what we teach. It's bringing things to the forefront as far as people that are having to form budgets now. And I was talking to students the other day in class, and I just asked the question, you know, how many of your parents have a budget? And one of the students said, well, mine does now. And I said, why is that? And she said, well, we've got a larger family now. And so some of the families have now started working on a budget because of different things that are going on in the economy.
All right. Well, Les Greer teaches business and economics and personal finance now at Riverdale High School in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Thanks very much for speaking with us, Les.
Thank you, Deborah.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, what would you do if you adopted a child from overseas and discovered that the child had been kidnapped? That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Over the last year, violence in Iraq has been at its lowest level since the U.S. invasion began in 2003. But two sophisticated suicide bombings this week could threaten the calm and could affect President Obama's plan to have all U.S. soldiers out of Iraq by 2011. Bobby Ghosh is senior editor at Time Magazine. He spent several years in Baghdad as bureau chief, and he joins us from Washington. Welcome.
Hi, Deb. Thanks.
We read that the top U.S. commander in Iraq, General Ray Odierno, told the Associated Press that it's unlikely the country will ask U.S. troops to stay past the 2011 deadline. What do you think of that? Is that something we can count on right now?
I think he's right. I think at the moment the prevailing political atmosphere in Iraq is such that it would Prime Minister Maliki would look very weak if he asked the Americans to stay. But of course, if the violence continues to rise, as it has done these past couple of weeks, then he may not have any choice, and it may become clear to him that the Iraqi forces are not ready to take on the responsibilities, and he may have a change of heart.
Mm-hmm. The bombings this week that we mentioned were against Iraqi soldiers. They both occurred in high-security areas. Some are suggesting more sophisticated in the past. What does the type of attacks that have come about recently suggest?
Well, the fact that they're suicide bombings, and the fact that they were aimed at government security forces, point toward extremist groups like Al-Qaeda and its associates, which remain a threat in Iraq, although they have suffered quite a beating in the past year. The fact that these attacks took place so close to Baghdad, where Al-Qaeda is supposed to have been quite thoroughly destroyed, suggests to me that they've been able to regenerate to some degree, and also that they're getting cooperation from very likely Sunni tribes in the neighborhood of the capital.
Hmm. So you would agree with the assessment that perhaps these attacks are symbolic of some sort of joining forces with Sunni insurgents in an attempt to destabilize Iraq?
Absolutely. There's no way Al-Qaeda can function in Iraq without substantial local support, and there's certainly no way that they can strike so close to the capital. They have had alliances with Sunni tribes in the past. Recently, some of those tribes have come over to the American side. But the fact that those tribal loyalties are very fickle has been underscored by these attacks. Just as the U.S. was able to pull the tribes away from Al-Qaeda, it's always going to be possible that Al-Qaeda will be able to win them back.
Hmm. There are a lot of events coming up, if you will, in Iraq where security will likely be tested in the coming months. You've got national elections coming at the end of this year. Where do you think security might have to be to figure out whether these attacks undermine security improvements in Iraq?
Well, you know, if you go by the past 5 years, Al-Qaeda and its associates have almost made a point of not attacking during major events that have big security. Elections in Iraq have been held on a number of occasions, and on each of those cases, the vote went through quite peacefully. There's been a lot of violence leading up and then a lot of violence following. So it suggests to me that Al-Qaeda is quite aware of the security environment, and they also like to take the path of sort of least risk to their operation. So they want to strike when people are not prepared. That's when they get the maximum publicity. That's when they get the maximum deadly efficiency of those attacks. So I wouldn't put too much emphasis on particular events like an election. I think we will watch how the violence, what the numbers look like over the course of the spring and the summer. And if by the middle of the year violence has ratcheted up to a substantial degree, I suspect there will be a recalculation, both by the Iraqi government as well as by the U.S. military.
Mm-hmm. So it would be based on numbers? People would look at numbers of attacks to determine whether security has improved?
I think so. I think people will look at a number of attacks. They will also look at the kinds of attacks. If they're, in the past, Al-Qaeda has sort of mixed it up a little bit. It attacks government targets, but it also does a lot of attacking of civilian targets, marketplaces, schools, restaurants. If more of those begin to pop up again, it would make people afraid to leave their homes again. It would make people afraid to go to public places. And that changes the atmosphere. That changes the politics.
Well, Bobby Ghosh, senior editor at Time Magazine, you spent several years in Baghdad as bureau chief. Thanks very much for being with us.
Anytime, Tim.
Before we go today, pepping up late winter meals. It's Here and Now. Welcome back. Thousands of people took to the streets in Northern Ireland today protesting the dissident Irish Republican Army groups that have claimed responsibility for the recent murders of two British soldiers and a policeman. A lunchtime vigil in Belfast attracted workers, mothers with their children, and former paramilitary convicts carrying signs that said, "No going back," referring to the decades before the 1998 Good Friday Peace Accord, in which almost 4,000 people were killed. Audrey Carville hosts the BBC's Europe Today program. Before that, she worked for the BBC in Belfast, Northern Ireland. And Audrey, can you tell us about these dissident IRA groups that have claimed responsibility for these killings? Who are they and what do they want?
Deborah, there are two groups involved in this. The Continuity IRA, which killed the police officer earlier this week, and then the larger and more dangerous group, the Real IRA, which murdered the two British soldiers on Saturday night. Now, both of these groups have been formed over the last 20 years or so, and they have grown out of the Provisional IRA. That's the mainstream IRA, which engaged in a war with the British armed forces in Northern Ireland since 1969. Both of these groups essentially opposed the IRA's decision to lay down their weapons, their bombs, their guns, and along with their political representatives, Sinn Féin, to engage in a peaceful and political strategy with a view to sharing power with their age-old enemies, the Protestant stroke unionist community in Northern Ireland. So both of these groups opposed that. They broke away, they formed their own groups because they firmly believe in the old traditional republican view that as long as Britain occupies a part of Ireland, people in Ireland have a right to resist with arms.
But why now? Why are these happening now?
Honestly, these attacks, which have been taking place over the last few days, could have taken place at any point over the last 2 years, especially since the power-sharing government between Sinn Féin and Ian Paisley, the firebrand Protestant leaders, Democratic Unionist Party, agreed to share power in 2007. The Real IRA, that's the bigger of the two splinter groups, they have been undergoing a massive reorganization, a restructuring. They've become leaner and meaner. They have recruited people across the island of Ireland. They've been importing weapons from abroad, and they've been waiting to get into a strong position to launch an attack like this, and this is what they have done.
Is there any indication that these attacks may be in response to the visit to the United States, where the unity government leaders are heading here today, I believe, heading to this country today, trying to get American support for the peace process?
Certainly the visit by Martin McGuinness and Peter Robinson to Washington, to the White House, provides a great opportunity for people opposed to the peace process to do something which will undermine that. There are other issues going on within the Northern Ireland government at the moment too. They are trying to take control of policing and justice and security issues, and that's being very controversial at the moment as well. So the government itself is in quite a fragile state. So the dissident paramilitary groups know that and they want to exploit it.
What is it that the government leaders hope to achieve in the United States?
Well, certainly before these killings happened, the main aim of their trip would have been to promote investment, because Northern Ireland, like many other places around the world at the moment, is suffering from the economic downturn. It has experienced a boom in the years after the Good Friday Agreement was signed. Lots of investment, particularly from America. But of course, like everywhere else, that is falling off now because of the recession. So that would have been the main aim before Saturday night. Clearly, since Saturday night and since the killing of the police officer, they will also be at pains to remind the administration in Washington that these are a small minority of people who are doing this, that the vast majority of people are still absolutely committed to peace, and they will still be looking for American support for that.
Do you think that the violence may actually have backfired and that it may unify the government and strengthen the whole peace process?
There is no doubt that that is what the political leaders have been saying and demonstrating over the last 48 hours or so. Let me tell you about an image yesterday, Deborah, Tuesday. We saw Martin McGuinness, a former IRA commander, now a senior Sinn Féin politician, standing shoulder to shoulder with Hugh Orde. He is the man responsible for policing in Northern Ireland. He's the chief constable. Now, bear in mind that 10, 15, 20 years ago, Martin McGuinness, as a commander of the IRA, was plotting the murders of police officers in Northern Ireland. And yet on Tuesday, there he was standing side by side with Hugh Orde, pledging his complete support for the police, saying that he would give the police any information that he had on the killers, and urging the people who support him to do the same. And not only that, he went on to describe the men who carried out all of these killings as traitors, as betraying the people of the island of Ireland. And to use the word traitor in the Northern Ireland context is extremely inflammatory. Words like that have caused bitter and violent divisions among Republicans in the decades past. So very harsh words from him, and definitely a determination by all politicians that this will not derail the peace process.
Huh. Do you think that there's a chance that British troops could return to the streets of Northern Ireland?
I don't think so. And certainly Hugh Orde on Tuesday made that point very, very clearly, that it was not his aim to have British soldiers back on the streets. They are very mindful that they should not do anything which will be seen as an overreaction, thereby provoking people who might support the paramilitaries who carried out the killings to join up to carry out even more violence. So they are very, very mindful of not creating the circumstances which would extend this period of violence.
You used to work in Belfast, Northern Ireland.
I did.
What was the situation like when you worked there, and can you make a comparison to what it's like today?
Yes, I worked there in the early 1990s, before the ceasefire of the IRA and the Loyalist paramilitaries was put in place. And really, there is no comparison between the Northern Ireland of then and the Northern Ireland of today. In those days, it was a simply awful place to live and to work, because everything, cities, towns, they were like ghost towns. No one would be on the streets after 6 o'clock in the evening. No one would really go out on a Saturday night. You would always be very, very worried about where you were going in case you got caught up in the wrong place at the wrong time. And then, of course, every day you were waking up to stories of people being shot and bombed. And particularly in 1993, just before the ceasefires, every day there were at least three people being shot or bombed in Northern Ireland. Now, clearly, that has all changed. People say that the peace process hasn't delivered total peace to Northern Ireland, and that is true. But compared to what it was like, today's Northern Ireland is a completely different place. There's economic prosperity, but more importantly, people can live their lives free of fear.
All right. The BBC's Audrey Carville speaking with us from London about the recent violence in Northern Ireland. Audrey, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Deborah.
Just a reminder, you can listen to today's show stream live on our website, hereandnow.org. For past programs, click on Archives. Also, you can download a podcast and take us with you wherever you go. That's hereandnow.org. Back in a minute. Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. Spring officially begins next week, but for many of us, it'll be a few months before fresh produce is available at local farmers' markets. So, what do you do to liven up a late winter meal, especially if you don't want to spend a lot of money? That's the problem Here and Now's resident chef Kathy Gunst set out to solve for Lucia Keegan Sullivan, a mother of two who lives in Belmont, Massachusetts. And full disclosure, Lucia is married to our own Here and Now producer, Kevin Sullivan. She met Kathy at the supermarket.
What would be your goal? What are you looking for the most in terms of sort of upping the quality of the food you put on the table every day?
I would like to be able to cook something that is pretty easy to make, you know, that I could get on the table in about half an hour, and something that's healthy and incorporates vegetables and whole grains, things like that.
Okay, let's give it a try. Let's look around. Let's see. We're at the produce section, which is generally near the front of a lot of stores, and there's always lemons, and everyone buys lemons, but there's also always limes, and no one buys limes. And the thing about limes, particularly in the winter when there's not a lot of fresh produce, is that they have a really lively, bright flavor. And the zest on a lime, if you grate it into a salad dressing or over chicken or into vegetable dishes, really, really wakes things up. So maybe we'll grab a lime and see if that works in. What about fresh ginger? That's another one of those flavor boosters. It's fresh all year round. It's really inexpensive, and it's got an incredibly bright, fresh flavor. Now, the only thing you want to look for here is that it's not mushy at all. And this looks pretty good, actually. How about Brussels sprouts? Does that bore you?
No, I would love to do Brussels sprouts.
Because Brussels sprouts is like everyone's least favorite vegetable, and it's got huge potential.
Okay.
So let's grab a few of those.
That sounds great.
One of the things I thought about to flavor the Brussels sprouts is to add pancetta, which is an Italian bacon. It's a dry cured bacon, but it's got not only a salty flavor, but a peppery flavor, which adds a lot of dimension to food. So this is great stuff. Let's go take a look at meat and fish options. Are there certain things that everyone hates in your household and everyone loves? That'll help us shop.
We're omnivores, so I think pretty much everyone eats everything. And I know Kevin said he's sick of chicken, but chicken's an easy thing, you know, to get protein, and it's sort of neutral. It sort of takes on the flavor of whatever you're making, so it seems like it's sort of a staple food.
Grocery, line three, please.
I often buy the cutlets or the sort of smaller cuts of the boneless chicken breast because it's faster, but I know it's probably not the most economical thing.
Well, in fact, chicken breast tenders, those are $5.69 a pound. Here we have boneless skinless thigh, $2.89 a pound. I want you to try it.
We'll
do something really
but
cool with it.
Can we disguise it so it doesn't look like...
Absolutely. Okay, here's what I'm thinking. We have fresh ginger. We have the lime. How do you feel about coconut milk?
Love coconut milk.
Okay, let's do like an instant, quickie, Asian-y, Thai-flavored chicken dish. And I don't think anyone's going to say, wait, that's dark meat.
I think that sounds great.
Let's try it. Okay.
Hi.
Hi there. Great. So hopefully there's something that came out of those grocery bags or several things that excite you, because I truly do believe that if you become excited by the ingredients that you buy in the store, your cooking is going to be infused with an excitement.
Good.
So we're going to start with a large skillet. We're going to use a high heat, and we're just going to start by seasoning the chicken with salt and pepper.
Why does the oil have to be hot before you put the chicken in?
It's a really good question, because you want to sear quickly. What we're going to do is brown this chicken, then we're going to take it out, then we're going to add our ginger and some scallions and our coconut milk, and we're going to make the basis of the sauce, and then we're going to add the chicken back in. Basically, it's like deglazing the pan because we have little bits of chicken on the bottom, so we want to scrape them up. So this is good. It's going to come to a boil, and we're just going to try to let release all the good flavors from the chicken there. Okay, and then we're going to add our coconut milk. Now, this is thick and rich, and we're not going to add too much to begin with. See, it's not really a milk. It's so thick and solid. This is just going to melt right into the broth and give us a really good sauce. Now, we got that lime, and I don't want to add lime juice because I think it'll be too sour at this point. But what I'm going to do, let that cook down for a minute, is I'm going to wash the outside of the lime, and then we're going to grate the zest or the rind. The whole thing takes about 20 minutes, but if you wanted to, you could cook it on Sunday and have it on Monday. You could cook it in the morning and have it in the evening.
Right.
Okay, so it's starting to simmer. The coconut milk is melted. We're going to put our chicken back in.
Okay.
Okay, so for the Brussels sprouts, all we're going to do is trim the end off and then the absolute one or two outer leaves. So the prep time is less than 5 minutes, just to trim and then the outer leaves. Trim, outer leaves come off. We're just going to rinse these. Where's that roasting pan? Oh, here it is. Okay.
Do we need to do something with the pancetta?
Yeah, that's going to come on next. Okay. And we need just a tiny bit of olive oil. We don't need a lot of fat because of the pancetta. Just kind of coarsely chop it. It's going to add huge flavor to the Brussels sprouts. And I'm just going to toss it with my hands because I don't want it to clump up in one place. That's it. We preheated the oven to 425. We're going to pop it in, and we're not going to touch it for a good 15 minutes. This is something else that's huge that will make you like cooking more. If you clean up as you go, even if there are kids crawling at your feet, put something away when you're done with it or rinse it off and put it to the side so that at the end of the night, it's just not this nightmare of dishes. I think this is another place people get in trouble with. We're going to test these Brussels sprouts. They've really kind of glazed up. The pancetta looks cooked the way bacon looks cooked. We're going to just take a small sharp knife and put it into the Brussels sprout, and I just want you to feel that. That's tender, it's done, it's ready to serve.
Looks really good.
Let's check our chicken. And it's cooked. We're going to turn it off. You're going to reheat it when your family's ready to sit down.
Oh, that's so nice. And it's light.
It's very light. That was the idea. Lots of flavors, not a lot of calories, not a lot of money, but big flavors in your mouth. That's what you're looking for year-round, but particularly this time of year. So we've used all these really great key ingredients like ginger and lime and coconut milk. And I think the three of those maybe cost about $3 or $4, but they added huge flavor to kind of an everyday family winter meal.
That's Here and Now's resident chef, Kathy Gunst, cooking with Lucia Keegan-Sullivan at Lucia's home in Belmont, Massachusetts. Kathy also, by the way, made a winter salad that goes beyond the usual lettuce and tomato. To see that recipe, as well as the braised chicken and Brussels sprouts, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Robin Young will be back tomorrow. Please join us again, Here and Now.